I want you to picture a massive heavy oak table, like a giant banquet table.
Right. Okay.
And it's set perfectly for a feast, with literally all the wealth of the world piled incredibly high on top of it. Coins, plates, everything.
Sounds pretty good so far.
Right, but now imagine a machine comes along and just effortlessly flips that entire table into the air.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, everything goes flying, and when the plates and the coins finally hit the floor, they do not land where they were before, like at all.
It's just total chaos.
Exactly. Some people who had absolutely nothing are suddenly standing exactly where the gold rains down, and others who had it all are just left holding empty plates.
It is a chaotic image, yeah. But historically speaking, it paints a really accurate picture of how economies undergo radical transformations.
And that table flip is extreme wealth generation. There's a very strong argument right now that we are living right in the middle of the biggest one yet.
Yeah, I mean, you just have to look at the numbers.
Exactly. Consider that quote floating around right now. The one attributed to the tech CEO Jensen Huang, suggesting that over the next 5 years, AI is going to mint more millionaires than the internet managed to do in 20.
Which is a staggering claim, honestly.
It is. And if you look at the markets, the financial stakes are just astronomical. Like, we recently saw SpaceX close the largest IPO in history at a $1.75 trillion valuation.
Trillion with a T. It's wild.
Right. The sheer scale of capital moving around right now is just really hard to wrap your head around.
We are essentially watching the architecture of the global economy get rewritten in real time, like block by block.
Which is exactly why we are here today. So, welcome to the Deep Dive. Our mission today is to unpack a genuinely fascinating essay that analyzes insights from two major Asian finance shows.
Yeah, one focusing on like market attractiveness and the other on decoding market signals.
Right. And just to be clear for you listening, the goal of this analysis isn't to give you stock picks or, predict which specific company gets rich.
Definitely not.
We want to decode the hidden mechanism of how technology actually reshuffles wealth. And we really want to explore why AI might completely break a 150-year-old historical pattern of how that wealth gets distributed.
Because the common assumption is always that a rising tide lifts all boats, right? Or that every major technological breakthrough just automatically creates a massive new middle class.
Yeah, that's what we're taught in history class.
Right. But this source makes a really compelling case that relying on that assumption this time around might be dangerous.
Okay, let's unpack this. Starting with a foundational premise from the essay, which is that not every technology actually redistributes wealth.
Yeah, we all get distracted by the shiny new gadgets.
We really do. But the source points out that to actually flip that oak table, a technology has to meet two very strict conditions.
And what's fascinating here is that the first condition isn't about how sophisticated the tech itself is. It is entirely about economics.
Okay.
The technology needs a positive feedback flywheel of increasing marginal returns.
Wait, hold on. A positive feedback flywheel of increasing marginal returns.
Yeah, I know, it's a mouthful.
That sounds like something you would only hear in like an upper-level economics seminar. Break that down for me. What does that actually look like to a normal person out in the real world?
Fair enough. Think about opening a traditional brick-and-mortar coffee shop.
All right.
If you invest $100,000, you might attract 100 regular customers,
All
right?
right.
If you invest another 100,000 to expand, you probably won't get another 100 customers because you've already tapped out the immediate neighborhood. The returns diminish.
Ah, okay. You hit a ceiling.
Exactly. But increasing marginal returns means the exact opposite. It means the more effort, capital, or users you pour into a system, the cheaper and easier it becomes to acquire the next user.
Oh, I see.
Think of a telephone network. The very first telephone was completely useless.
Right, who are you going to call?
Exactly. But the millionth telephone was incredibly valuable because it could connect to all the other phones. The payoff curve gets steeper over time.
Okay, so it has to spread like wildfire and actually gain momentum
Right.
rather than just kind of hitting a wall.
Spot on.
And what happens if a technology doesn't have that flywheel?
The market just absorbs it. It becomes a useful tool. Maybe it improves efficiency slightly. And the economy basically just goes back to equilibrium.
So no tables get flipped.
No tables get flipped.
Which brings in the second condition from the text, which is the right institutional and cultural soil.
Yes, this is crucial.
Because you can invent something brilliant, but if the legal framework or the infrastructure or just the culture isn't ready to adopt it, it just dies on the vine.
Right.
The essay actually points out that historically, a lot of European inventions didn't really bear economic suit until they landed in the regulatory and cultural environment of America.
Yeah, it needed the right soil to grow.
Exactly. But here is the real kicker. When you apply those two filters, the flywheel and the soil, the author estimates that only about 5% of technologies even reach a growth phase capable of changing wealth distribution.
5%. So 95% of the time, the hype is truly just hype.
Just a new shiny toy.
Right. But for that 5%, the essay lays out a sequential blueprint for how the reshuffle actually happens.
Okay, walk me through it.
It goes like this. Technology changes the constraint. The constraint changes the network. The network changes the bottleneck. The bottleneck changes bargaining power. And finally, bargaining power changes the wealth distribution.
Wow. That feels like the skeleton key to the entire past century of economic history.
It really is.
It's not just about making a process faster. It's about redefining what a resource even is.
Yes.
Like, I love the analogy the essay used about gasoline.
Oh, yeah, that's a great one.
Because before the internal combustion engine came along, gasoline was a completely useless byproduct of making kerosene. Like, nobody wanted it. It was literal industrial waste.
And then the technology changed the constraint. Suddenly, society needed a highly combustible liquid fuel for engines, and the waste became the prime asset.
It's wild to think about.
Yeah, the wealth code of any given era is often just spotting what is about to turn from a byproduct into a necessity.
But if you are sitting in the middle of this network as it gets rewired, how do you know if you were the one catching the gold?
Right, how do you measure it?
Yeah, and the source actually offers an equation for this. It says a node's value equals its traffic multiplied by its retention rate.
Traffic times retention.
Right. Traffic is just getting the opportunity, so people or data flowing through your point in the network. But retention is your ability to basically collect a toll.
You need a toll booth, because traffic without retention is basically just noise.
Exactly. And the text gives this hilarious but kind of painful example of a Chinese barbecue town that went completely viral for a season.
Oh, right, yeah.
They had massive traffic. People were driving from all over the country just to eat there, but they had zero retention.
None.
They didn't have a unique brand. They didn't have proprietary supply chains. And they didn't have a way to lock those visitors into, like, a recurring ecosystem.
Because anyone else could just roast meat on a skewer.
Exactly. So despite all the incredible traffic, no lasting wealth accumulated. It was a busy summer, and then it was just over.
A place that keeps the traffic is where the wealth forms. And to figure out where AI's toll booths are going to be built, we have to look at the evolution of bottlenecks through the three great reshuffles that came before it.
Let's do that. Starting with railroads and the goods network. This ran roughly from 1850 to 1890, and it smashed the constraint of physical distance.
Yes, physical distance was the big one.
Because before railroads, you had to move goods by cart or canal, meaning your circulation radius was incredibly small. Every town was its own isolated market.
Yeah.
You'd have wildly different prices for basic goods just a few miles apart just because of transport costs.
Railroads completely obliterated that constraint, driving the cost per ton kilometer into the ground. But notice how the blueprint applies here. The network rewired and the new toll booths appeared at the junction.
Where the lines crossed.
Exactly. Wealth concentrated wherever the steel lines crossed.
The essay points to Zhengzhou as a prime example of this. It's just a minor county next to some ancient capitals. But because the Beijing-Hankou railway line had to shift west around the Yellow River, and it intersected with the Longhai line right there, Zhengzhou just exploded into a massive logistics center.
Right. And the same goes for Shijiazhuang, which was literally just a village that got hauled in by the train.
Hauled in by the train. I love that phrase.
It's great. But the real estate underneath didn't actually matter, right?
Yeah.
It was the traffic flowing over it that generated the value.
Which brings up that fascinating study by the economic historians Donaldson and Hornbeck.
Oh, yeah. They quantified this shift perfectly.
They found that from 1870 to 1890, a county's market access was capitalized into its farmland value at nearly a one-to-one ratio.
It's incredible.
They concluded that if you magically removed every U.S. railroad in 1890, it would have erased about 60% of the total value of U.S. agricultural land.
60%.
Let's translate that to today, because that number is just hard to process.
Right.
That would be like someone pulling the plug on Amazon Web Services and the global GPS system simultaneously, and watching real estate prices in New York and London drop by 60% just because no one can process a trade.
The infrastructure literally becomes the geography. But, you know, building a national railroad network is brutally expensive.
Yeah, laying all that steel.
It's a very heavy asset, capital-intensive game.
Which meant your average craft commerce couldn't fund it. And this bottleneck actually birthed modern finance.
Right, Wall Street, basically.
Yeah. Railroad bonds, investment banks, securities exchanges, they all had to be invented to fund the capital expenditure for the trains.
And the people who controlled that finance became the new royalty, which ushered in the Gilded Age, where the top 1% held nearly half of all the wealth in the nation.
Just extreme concentration.
Yes.
But once physical distance was solved, it just exposed the next major limitation of the era, which was energy. And that leads to electricity and oil running from 1870 to 1920.
Right, moving from movement to power.
Because before electricity, a steam age factory was literally chained to the earth. It had to sit right next to a coal deposit or a fast-moving river. But electricity meant energy could travel over a grid, allowing factories to move wherever it made the most economic sense.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, once energy and location were no longer the bottleneck, the new toll booth became brain power and skill.
The economy shifted from trading muscle to trading complex coordination.
Exactly.
And this is where we see the absolute miracle of this era, which is the birth of a mass middle class.
Yes, but the essay makes a really crucial point here. This middle class wasn't some charity project by rich industrialists.
No, not at all. And I want to bring up the economic historian Paul David here because he documented this wild paradox. When factories first installed electric motors, their productivity actually flatlined for years.
Yeah, they didn't just instantly make more money by plugging into the grid.
No, because you couldn't just, you know, swap a steam engine for an electric motor and turn it on. They had to completely tear down and reorganize the entire factory floor into an assembly line.
Right.
And to manage that entirely new, incredibly complex mode of production, they had to hire literal armies of people.
Which means the new system fundamentally needed human labor to run it.
Technicians, clerks, middle managers.
Yeah, the middle class was a mechanical requirement of the technology itself.
Wow. Which sets the stage perfectly for the internet era. From roughly 1990 to the present day, we solved energy, so the next bottleneck was information.
Right, the internet smashed the space-time constraint of data. It fused customer flow, goods flow, and capital flow all into this real-time global exchange.
And the new toll booth just became attention. You sell the ads, run the cloud infrastructure, and handle the payments.
Exactly. But the internet era was uniquely what they call light asset winner-take-all.
Explain that.
Well, if you build a software platform, the marginal cost of adding one more user is virtually zero.
Oh, right. It doesn't cost you anything to have another person download an app.
Exactly. The margins were enormous, which allowed massive monopolies to form incredibly fast. But, and this is key, despite being asset light, the internet still shared that crucial trait with electricity.
Which was?
It still had a massive appetite for people.
Ah.
Think about it. It required programmers, designers, live streamers, and huge, huge fleets of gig workers to actually function in the real world.
So if we look at those first three eras, railroads, electricity, the internet, they all basically followed a concentrate then broaden pattern.
Right.
They minted wealthy tycoons at the infrastructure layer, but they eventually expanded the middle class because the new networks strictly needed ordinary people to operate.
They couldn't run without us.
Exactly. But here's where it gets really interesting. We are now arriving at AI.
Yeah.
And AI isn't moving goods, it isn't moving energy, and it's not just moving information.
No, it is rewiring the task network.
A task network.
Yeah, we are talking about cognition and execution. The essay points out that a task that used to bounce from, say, a manager to an employee to an outsourcer might now just pass straight through a large language model or an AI agent.
With maybe just one human signing off at the very end.
Exactly.
So the toll booths are splitting into a hard end and a soft end, and the hard end is the infrastructure. But unlike the internet, AI is a heavy asset, winner-take-all game.
Oh, absolutely. It is a total return to the railroad era.
Right, because every single AI inference burns immense compute power. Just to give you an idea, the International Energy Agency estimates that global data center electricity demand will roughly double by 2030.
Wow.
That's hitting nearly 945 terawatt hours.
That is a staggering physical footprint.
It is, which raises a really important question about value capture here. Who is actually paying the bill for all of this?
Right, because someone has to build all those data centers.
Exactly. And the essay uses a brilliant analogy with the Apple supply chain. For years, the suppliers in Asia had these humming factories and all the orders, but they had to front the massive capital expenditures for the manufacturing equipment.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah. Their profit margins were razor thin, while Apple essentially kept all the real value.
Right.
So applying that to AI, it looks glorious right now because a few massive cloud giants are buying chips and building data centers. But their cash flows cannot cover the spend.
They're essentially borrowing from the future.
Yes, they're borrowing billions to keep building this trillion-dollar CapEx railroad. And if consumer subscriptions or corporate labor savings don't eventually catch up to that spend, someone is going to be left holding a very, very empty bag.
And while capital fights over that heavy infrastructure, the hard end, we really have to look at the soft end, which is the new human toll booth.
What does that look like?
Well, an AI model operates purely symbol to symbol. It processes data left behind by humans, but it has no actual experience of the physical world.
The text uses a really great phrase for this. It says, "Skill depreciates, Dell appreciates."
Yes.
Basically, the mechanical skill of executing a task gets cheaper, but the Dell, like the guiding philosophy, the nuanced judgment, the humanity of the work that becomes infinitely more valuable.
Because AI unbundles jobs into individual tasks.
Right. Break that down for me. How does that work in practice?
Take a corporate lawyer, for example. The tasks of drafting a standard document or, searching through case law, those depreciate to near zero.
Right, and AI could do that in seconds.
Exactly. But the task of risk judgment, the ability to sit right across from a panicked client and actually persuade them, or the willingness to literally carry the legal liability if a strategy fails.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, those tasks appreciate massively because an algorithm cannot go to jail and it can't pay a malpractice settlement out of its own pocket.
Right.
It fundamentally takes a human to bear risk.
But this repricing is hitting the exact people who really thought they were safe. Like the IMF data cited in the essay notes that 40% of jobs globally are exposed to AI.
40%.
Yeah, but in advanced economies, that jumps to 60% because cognitive work just makes up a much larger share of the economy.
It's the white-collar workers in the crosshairs this time.
So what does this all mean?
Well, the essay concludes with a genuinely chilling realization. For the individual, AI is a superpower. But for society, it is a dispersive force.
A dispersive
Yes.
force.
Think about the scale of human organization. A major internet company today might employ 100,000 people,
Sure.
but a top-tier AI model lab only needs a few hundred. And an AI agent startup might need like a dozen.
Wow.
The sharper the technological edge gets, the fewer humans it actually needs to carry with it.
Okay, let me just play devil's advocate here for a second.
Sure, go for it.
Because when the internet was commercializing around, say, 1995, people wrote the exact same doom and gloom think pieces.
They did.
They swore it would destroy retail, wipe out travel agents, and basically just leave everyone unemployed.
Yeah.
But instead, it created millions of jobs. Social media managers, cloud architects, app developers, stuff that we simply couldn't conceive of at the time.
That's true.
So why are we so confident that AI won't just create a massive new category of like AI middle-class jobs that we just can't picture yet?
It is a very fair pushback, but the mechanics are fundamentally different here. The internet still required human labor to build the bridges between the digital and the physical worlds.
Okay.
Like someone still had to drive the Uber, someone had to literally pack the e-commerce box in the warehouse.
Right. The real world is messy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But AI is fundamentally designed to execute those coordination and cognitive tasks autonomously. So it might just rerun the extreme wealth concentration of the Gilded Age, but skip the middle class expansion entirely.
Just skip it.
Yeah, simply because this specific mode of production just doesn't have a structural requirement for a massive human workforce.
Man, that is a heavy thought. The only real silver lining the author offers is this concept of institutional lag.
Which is really important to remember.
It is. The idea is that technology always moves faster than the laws that govern it. So railroads forced modern company law into existence. Electricity forced labor laws, the internet forced data privacy regulations.
Right.
And right now, we are just in the whiplash of the first AI shock. But the correction out, things like compute governance, copyright reworks, those things are coming.
They are, but the concrete of this new economic network is drying fast. The author notes that where wealth flows is basically decided the moment the network takes its final shape.
The table is flipping right now.
It is. Which leaves you, listening right now, with a critical question to consider.
What's that?
Well, if human value is retreating to the realm of real-world liability and deep interpersonal trust, what happens in a decade when AI agents are granted legal entity status?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, think about it. What happens when an AI can hold its own insurance policy, sign a binding contract, and actually be sued in a court of law, absorbing its own liability?
If that happens, the ultimate human toll booth might just disappear entirely.
Completely.
That completely redefines what it means to be essential. Take a hard look at your own task network this week and figure out how to be the toll booth before you end up as the bypassed road. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We will see you next time.